He came, he opened the door, and he was screaming, "Come on, help me. Somebody shot my mother and father." And everyone ran out of the bar, and that was it.
They all took off.
No, I had to stay. I was tending more. They all jumped in his car and took off.
Today, police combed the DeFeo's handsome three-story house for clues while divers explored the backyard swimming pool for the still-unfound murder weapon. Police have been questioning the son, Ronald, and now say he is being, quote, safeguarded. Investigators say without explanation that they now feel young DeFeo was in the house at the time of the murders, but they're not yet considering him a suspect.
And so
we
forth.
We have no suspect at this time. We have no indication of the motive at this time.
What about Ronald DeFeo, the son, the surviving son?
Ronald is being safeguarded by the Suffolk County Police at this time.
Why safeguarded?
Why? Because there's six members of the family dead, and we don't know why, and he's the sole remaining member.
Is he also a suspect?
He's not a suspect at this time.
Few people in the neighborhood knew the family well, but those who did described them as close-knit.
Well, I think they were just very sweet, very religious people, very family-minded people. And that's about all I could say. Very good, very generous, this type. You're very close with their children.
There's one element in the usual mass murder story which seems to be missing from this case. There's no sense of fear in this community. No feeling of a mass murderer on the loose. People we talk to seem to feel that whatever was the motive for this crime, it had something to do with the family. It's not something that's going to return to bother anyone else. In Amityville, Long Island, Phil Barno, News Center 4.
It started with a young man running into a bar shouting, "Help me, I think my mother and father were shot." What followed was the uncovering of one of the most horrifying crimes in suburban history. Six family members murdered in their sleep. The perpetrator, the lone survivor of the household. What drove him to commit such an unthinkable act? Was it insanity, demonic voices, or something even darker? Tonight, we delve into the real-life crime that began the legend of Amityville Horror. This episode unravels the chilling story of the DeFeo family murders. We'll explore the troubled dynamics within the family, the events leading up to the crime, and the shocking brutality of what happened on November 13th, 1974. Then we'll follow the investigation and trial that captured national attention, the inconsistencies and mysteries surrounding the case, and the complex, often contradictory personality of Ronald Butch DeFeo Jr. By the end of this episode, you'll see how this tragedy set the stage for one of the most infamous haunted house stories in history. This is Scarlet Tavern.
Clink!
We forgot our glasses. It's late. So, yeah. Amityville Horror. The DeFeo murders. So, part one, we'll talk about the actual murders that happened in the house, 112 Ocean Avenue.
One of my favorite horror movies. The original one from the 70s, not those god-awful remakes.
Haven't seen them, never will see them, and...
It's a great movie.
They're good movies.
I'm good.
And then part two, we'll talk about the actual haunting and make fun of the Warrens because
they're
massive pieces of shit. And yeah, they... the Warrens are definitely something else.
Which we may or may not be doing in the future, an episode on them.
They show up in one of our episodes at least.
Yeah, they definitely the Warrens, of course, are some of the most infamous of the ghost hunters and paranormal quote unquote experts.
Yeah. I think they have seen some stuff, but with the amount of activity that they claim that they've seen.
Statistically, they should have ran into something.
Exactly. I don't think they...
We won't get too delve into that, but suffice it to say, in my opinion, they're just a bunch of fraudsters who happen to stumble upon a few times the real thing to make it sound good, to sell it.
Not this bullshit again!
I was waiting for the right moment.
It is too late for that shit.
So, the story of the DeFeo family unfolds like a Shakespearean tragedy, where ambition, power, love, and resentment are intertwined. While the Dutch colonial home at 112 Ocean Avenue in Amityville stood as a symbol of suburban prosperity, it became a pressure cooker of unresolved conflicts, abuses of power, and hidden despair. Understanding the dynamics of the DeFeo family provides crucial insight into how their lives unraveled in such a catastrophic way. So, let's talk about the family. Ronald Big Ronnie DeFeo Sr., at the time of his death, he was 43. He was the ruler of the household.
As most Italian households are.
Yes. Ronnie grew up in a working class family, developing an intense desire to rise above his humble beginnings. His towering personality and penchant for control were both his strengths and his weaknesses. He saw his home and family as reflections of his success, demanding perfection and submission from all under his roof. Louise, a woman of retirement and grace, was drawn to Ronald Sr.'s strong personality in the early years of their marriage. However, their relationship soured over time due to his controlling and abusive behavior. Again, a lot of the old school Italian relationships. Despite their frequent arguments, Louise rarely confronted her husband, instead choosing to keep the peace for the sake of their children. Ronald Sr. employed intimidation as his primary means of authority. He believed his harsh methods were necessary to discipline his family and instill respect. Family members recalled moments where he would berate Luis and their children over minor infractions, sometimes resorting to physical violence to assert dominance. Luis DeFeo, who was 43 at the time of her death, was the passive matriarch. She came from a wealthy family, as was accustomed to a life of comfort and stability. Her father, Michael Briganti, adored her and supported her financially throughout her marriage. Marrying Ronald Sr. marked a turning point in her life as she transitioned from a world of privilege to one dominated by tension and control. Louise often served as a mediator, attempting to shield her children from her husband's wrath. However, her inability to stand up to him left the children vulnerable. Her financial dependence on her father limited her options for escape, as she feared losing her home and stability if she left Ronald Sr. Then there's Ronald Butch DeFeo Jr., 23, the troubled eldest child. From an early age, Butch bore the brunt of his father's harsh expectations. Ronald Sr. believed his son needed to be toughened up, frequently belittling him for his perceived weakness. As a child, Butch was overweight and shy, often targeted by bullies at school. His father's criticism only exacerbated his insecurities. By his teenage years, Butch began to rebel against his father's authority. He experimented with drugs and alcohol, which provided an escape from his tumultuous home life. His relationships outside the family were often volatile, as he struggled to form meaningful connections. Butch's rebellious nature put him at odds with his siblings, particularly Dawn, who saw him as reckless and selfish. Despite these conflicts, Butch shared moments of camaraderie with his siblings, particularly Allison, who often tried to empathize with him. Dawn DeFeo, 18, the aspirational daughter. Dawn yearned for independence and viewed her family home as a prison. She frequently clashed with her father over her plans to move to Florida to be with her boyfriend. Her ambition to escape was met with resistance from her father, who saw her departure as a threat to his control over the family. Dawn often acted as a protector for her younger siblings, standing up to their father when he became too aggressive. Her relationship with Butch was marked by moments of both support and conflict, as they shared a mutual disdain for her father's dominance, but often clashed over their differing approaches to rebellion. Allison DeFeo, 13, the gentle mediator. Allison was known for a quiet demeanor and empathic nature. She often tried to diffuse tensions between her siblings and parents, serving as a voice of reason. Her gentle personality made her a confidant for her siblings, particularly Mark and John Matthew. Allison's attempts to mediate often placed her in difficult positions as she struggled to navigate the volatile dynamics of her family. Mark DeFeo, 12, the resilient athlete. Mark's love for football and other sports provided him an outlet for his energy and frustrations. He was dedicated to his athletic pursuits, often using them as a way to escape the chaos at home. At the time of the murders, Mark's injury left him bedridden, a condition that made him especially vulnerable to the events that unfolded. And finally, John Matthew DeFeo, 9, the innocent optimist. John Matthew's lively personality and youthful innocence were a source of light in an otherwise dark household. He often played with his older siblings, unaware of the deeper tensions that consumed his family. The DeFeo's Dutch colonial home was more than just a residence. It was a microcosm, whatever, of their lives. It's late, I'm tired. Purchased with financial assistance from Luis's father, the house represented the family's upward mobility. Its picturesque design and waterfront location exuded an air of affluence. The house became a theater for the family's internal conflicts. Its walls bore witness to countless arguments, outbursts, and moments of despair. The prominent statue of St. Joseph on the front lawn symbolized the family's Catholic faith, faith that Ronald Sr. frequently weaponized to enforce obedience and conformity. Typical old-school Italian Catholics.
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm going to beat you in the name of of St. Mary.
Well, yeah, that and just fuck you. I rule his house.
Where's the silly strike? He highlighted.
It was an accident.
That was his one warning. While the DeFeos appeared to live comfortably, their lifestyle was largely supported by Luis's father, Michael Briganti. Again, Briganti. Very Italian.
Mm-hmm.
Briganti's generosity was both a blessing and a burden, as it allowed the family to maintain their home, but also created tension between him and Ronald Sr. Butcher's frequent thefts and drug use added financial strain, further fueling the animosity between him and his father.
If I remember correctly, Ron Sr.'s father, he was a car salesman out of Brooklyn, if I believe. Did he work with his father?
Ronald Sr.?
Yeah, no. Ronald Sr.
I don't think so.
No, I don't believe so. I didn't see any.
Exactly, because that's how I remember, which we're going to find out. What he did was one of the excuses that Ronnie Jr. tried to use when the crimes were first committed.
Yeah, he said that his grandfather was part of the mob.
I thought it was his father.
No, his grandfather. Yeah, I don't think he worked. I think he blamed it on his grandfather for being part of the mob. Not his father. It was his grandfather.
Okay.
If Michael I remember. Briganti died in 1991. So, as the family's tensions mounted, several key incidents foreshadowed the tragic events of November 12th, 1974. Butch's failed attempt to stage a robbery at the family business deepened his father's distrust and anger. Butch's reliance on drugs escalated, making his behavior more erratic and unpredictable. Dawn's defiance and Butch's rebellion led to frequent confrontations with her father, creating an atmosphere of constant conflict. The nights of November 12th to the 13th, 1974, was marked by an eerie calm that would soon be shattered by one of the most horrific crimes in modern history. Ronald Butch DeFeo Jr., the eldest son of the DeFeo family, committed the unthinkable, the methodical and brutal murder of 6 family members while they lay asleep in their beds. To understand the events of the night is to delve into a series of calculated actions, chilling details, and unanswered questions that still haunt investigators and the public alike. On the evening of November 12, 1974, the DeFeo family followed their usual evening routine, with the children completing schoolwork and Ronald Sr. maintaining a tight grip on household order. Despite the semblance of normalcy, the atmosphere was charged with underlying tension, Butch had been out for most of the day drinking heavily and using drugs. Butch returned home late in the evening. Witness accounts suggest he was agitated, muttering about his father and seemingly lost in his own world. Family members likely saw his behavior as part of his ongoing struggles, unaware of the violent thoughts brewing in his mind. That evening, the family had dinner together, a rare occurrence given the growing estrangement between Butch and his parents. Some reports suggest Butch barely interacted, eating in silence before retreating to his room. A heated exchange reportedly occurred between Butch and his father. The argument stemmed from lingering tension over the staged robbery at the family car dealership and Butch's failure to contribute meaningfully to the household. After the altercation, Butch retreated to his room, possibly stewing in anger or planning his next steps. By midnight, the house had fallen silent. Each family member went to bed, their rooms spread across two floors. Butch, awake and pacing, reportedly retrieved the .35 caliber Marlin rifle he had stashed away. Around 3 a.m., Butch began his rampage, methodically moving from room to room. The precise order of the killings remains a subject of speculation, but forensic evidence provides a chilling reconstruction. Butch first targeted his parents, Ronald Sr. and Luis, as they lay asleep in their first floor bedroom. Ronald Sr. was shot twice in the back, with the bullets penetrating his kidneys and spine, killing him almost instantly. Luis awoke to the sound of gunfire, screaming in terror. Butch silenced her with two shots to the chest, one of which punctured her lung. Butch climbed the stairs to his eldest sister's room. Dawn, 18, was shot in the head, a bullet entering near her left ear and exiting through the right side of her skull. She likely died instantly. Allison, 13, was next. Butch aimed his rifle at her face, pulling the trigger and killing her instantly. The bullet shattered her face, leaving behind a devastating wound. Keep in mind, so this Marlin 35, it's similar to it's a lever action, similar to the rifle I have, except mine's bigger. Mine's a 308.
They're loud.
They're loud, and they leave about baseball size holes, especially from this close. And then the two youngest boys, Mark and John Matthew, shared a bedroom. Butch shot Mark in the back, the bullet piercing his spine and leaving him immobile. John Matthew was also shot in the back as he lay sleeping, the bullet puncturing his lungs and heart. Each victim was discovered laying face down in bed, hands above their heads, with no evidence of a struggle. This detail has puzzled investigators for decades. Theory suggests Butch may have ordered his family to lie face down before executing them, or that they were already positioned that way in their sleep, which I find unlikely. The absence of defensive wounds indicates the victims were caught completely off guard. Especially with the dad, I highly doubt he ordered him to do that, because the dad, even with Butch holding the gun, he would have fought back.
He would have charged him.
Yeah.
I think the
dad, and his dad was not a small guy.
Yeah, I think the dad, shot the dad first, get the biggest target out of the way. Then his mom wakes up screaming. He silences
Honestly,
her.
I think he shot them and then posed them.
Yes.
I think he posed them afterwards. Because he shot his sister in the face. So how does she end up like that? Face down in her bed, arms above her head.
Yeah.
So he posed them. I believe we're going to get into other theories about this, because there has another Long Island detective years later actually posed a theory that is interesting. But I'll wait till we actually get through the rest of everything before I say it.
The Marlin rifle used in the murders was loud, yet no neighbor reported hearing gunshots. Some theorize that a storm muffled the noise, while others speculated that Butch may have used a suppressor, though none was found. There's no suppressor available for a Marlin rifle.
Also, if I remember correctly, wasn't this, like, nowadays it's in a suburban built-up area, but back then this was a little bit of a property, like, the neighbors right next
to it. I mean, I think it was still suburban.
But they weren't, right next to each other.
Another possibility is that the victims were drugged, but toxicology reports later revealed no traces of sedatives in their system. Like I said, I think he kicks through the door, bang, bang, and then poses them after as he went through, killed everybody, and then went back through and posed everybody.
I'm just, it's always, again, if I don't, if he used a sedative, he used one that nobody was looking for, no one found.
I think that's too smart for him.
Yeah, I think it would have been something that he would have been easily.
Plus, how'd he get it? So, I mean, this kid's a druggie, but still.
It's not like your coroner drug dealer is selling you sedatives.
Yeah. So after completing the murders, Butch calmly took a shower, changed into fresh clothes, and began cleaning up. He gathered the rifle, bloody clothing, and spent shell casings, placing them in a pillowcase for disposal. On his way to work the next morning, Butch discarded the pillowcase in a storm drain near the family home. He later claimed to have thrown the rifle into a canal, though this detail remains unverified.
So, the way it looks is that they did have neighbors that would have
neighbors pretty close.
Yeah, that would have heard that gunshot.
But, I mean, if there's a storm and there's thunder, then it's possible.
That's probably the only way. You're right. I think they would have.
Butch arrived at work as usual, behaving as though nothing was amiss. Throughout the day, he made several phone calls to the family home, feigning concern over why no one was answering. He even complained to co-workers about his father's apparent absence, planting the idea that something was wrong. That afternoon, Butch left work early, spending time with friends at a local bar. He continued his charade, mentioning his inability to contact his family and expressing mild concern. Around 6:30 p.m. on November 13th, Butch burst into Henry's bar, a local hangout, shouting, "You've got to help me. My mother and father have been shot." His panic appeared genuine, convincing several bar patrons to accompany him back to the house.
So about 15 and a half hours later.
Yep. The group entered the home and immediately noticed the eerie silence. They proceeded to the bedrooms where they found the bodies of Ronald Sr. and Louise in their blood-soaked bed. One of the men called the police, who arrived within minutes to begin their investigation. Investigators were struck by the methodical nature of the killings. The victims appeared to have been executed while sleeping, with no signs of struggle or escape attempts. The house showed no signs of forced entry, ruling out an intruder. Butch, the only surviving member of the household, was immediately taken into custody for his protection. However, inconsistencies in his story quickly raised red flags. See, if it were me, I would have shot myself. Not kill myself. Shot myself. Hey, I escaped. Somebody else did this. I escaped. Look, here's the bullet wound. Boom. Suspicion gone.
Maybe. It's a better chance of it, but...
Hey, I woke up. I woke up. Nobody else did. Despite the loud gunfire, no family members awoke during the murders. Investigators theorized that the victims may have been drugged, but toxicology reports later debunked this idea. The rifle used was unsuppressed and extremely loud, yet neighbors reported hearing nothing unusual. Possibility of external noise, such as weather conditions, masking the shots, remains unverified. Butch's stated motive that voices told him to kill has been heavily scrutinized. Some believe the murders were driven by financial greed, as Butch stood to gain from his parents' life insurance policies. Others point to years of abuse and psychological turmoil as the primary factors. The investigation into the DeFeo murders began immediately after the discovery of the crime scene on the evening of November 13th, 1974. The Suffolk County Police were faced with a horrifying tableau. Six family members, all shot execution style in their beds, and the sole survivor, Ronald Butch DeFeo Jr., claimed to have stumbled upon the carnage. What initially appeared to be a targeted mob hit soon unraveled into a deeply disturbing and complex case, as inconsistencies in Butch's story emerged. The subsequent interrogation revealed a chilling portrait of a man capable of unimaginable violence. Police officers arrived at 112 Ocean Avenue within minutes of receiving the emergency call from the bar. They were led into the house by Butch and immediately observed the eerie silence and overwhelming stench of gunpowder and blood. Officers methodically searched the house and found the bodies of six victims all lying face down in their beds. The execution-style murders were carried out with precision, leaving no signs of struggle or resistance. And I will say, for those of you that have never entered a house filled with blood, it has a very specific scent. So do dead bodies. Just imagine pennies. So pennies have a smell to them. It's the copper. Imagine that times a million. You can smell it the second you walk in. You know when there's blood. And then, of course, most people know the smell of gunpowder.
Chlorine and all that.
So, but that smell of blood is, it's nothing you will ever forget. So Ronald Sr. and Louisa's room on the first floor, the parents were found in a large pool of blood with multiple gunshot wounds. Each of the children were found in their respective rooms, shot once or twice. Investigators noted the unusual positioning of the bodies as they were all face down, suggesting a calculated approach by the killer. Butch appeared distraught, pacing and muttering incoherently about the mob and his family's deaths. While his initial panic seemed genuine, officers quickly noted his composure was inconsistent with someone who had just been discovered, who had just discovered such a gruesome scene. He repeated a story about discovering the bodies after returning home from work and suggested that a mafia hitman named Luis Fellini might be responsible.
Now, initially, also, the mob theory wasn't discredited because also...
Oh, it was his father, but it was for alleged... We'll get into it.
Yeah, because the DeFeo's, his father's uncle was a capo, which is a captain in the Genovese family as well, so...
And Luis Fellini was a known hitman at the time for the mob.
What, I believe he was associated also with the Genovese as well. Could have been. I mean, mafia, hitman or hitman. So it did hold some initial water, but as we're going to see, it didn't.
It falls apart real fast.
So Butch claimed that his family had been targeted by the mob due to his father's alleged shady business dealings. He told police that he had seen signs of trouble leading up to the murder, such as strangers watching the house and threats made against his father. Butch also named Fellini, a known associate of organized crime, as a likely culprit, stating that his father had angered him over a business deal. And it was not uncommon, especially back then, the car business was big with mobsters. It was so easy to pull money in and out and wash it through that because... At that time, it was a cash business. There weren't credit companies.
No.
You weren't able to just buy a car with a credit card. You were coming in with cash, buying a car. And then not only, because again, especially back here, the mobsters are also dealing in drugs and guns. What easier place to hide them than in a car that you just sold to somebody? So now they're paying you $5,000 for the car, $10,000 or whatever for the guns or drugs. Boom, $15,000. They drive away with a nice car. But then here's all their product. It was so easy. And then they take the money. They sold the car, wash it. Boom, done. Goes out, buys another one.
Plus, the Genovese family was one of the known families of the five families of New York that engaged fairly openly in the drug trade. They were also one of the first to really kind of like expand outward into these, because usually at this point the mob is transitioning from the traditional numbers, gambling, prostitution, rackets. They're all still doing that, but now they're getting into more stuff. And also a lot of these associates are moving out of Brooklyn, which the DeFeos came from, leaving Brooklyn, and they're going to Long Island, New Jersey mostly, and just they're getting away from the city because they've got more money and nobody's watching them out here. The feds stand out like a fucking sore thumb in here, so it's a lot safer for them to just live out here and then work in the city.
Yeah, and then, I mean, I'm sure that after selling cars, they get a little tired.
Fuck you.
Speaking of mobs.
What do you mean?
Horatio Kane. His character was like very Italian, supposed to be Italian in CSI Miami.
I never watched that show.
It was the worst. It was the worst one.
I never got the Italian, however you fucking pronounce it.
Italian.
Fuck off.
So investigators found no evidence of a break-in, which contradicted Butch's claim of an outside attacker. The back door was unlocked, but there were no signs of a struggle or disturbance elsewhere in the house. Detectives noted that the precision of the killing, six victims shot in their sleep, did not align with typical mob hit patterns, which often involve public displays of violence as a warning. Additionally, the murder weapon, a 35 caliber Marlin rifle, is not commonly used by mobsters who typically preferred handguns or silenced weapons. And that is a thing. Mm-hmm. So if this was really a mob hit, they would have been out in their yard, sprawled out, and that, boom, here's your message. Actually, and they would not have missed somebody.
Also, they never would have killed him in his home for the very, just for practical reasons for this. The mob is going to kill you.
Yeah.
They will not kill your family. They will not kill your wife because they didn't do anything.
Unless you kill their wife. And then.
Well, that's,
the mob did have limits. They did have.
Most of it was practical. Again, you don't kill a man in your home. Why? Hollywood tell you, it's about respect. In reality, I really don't feel like killing women and children, so if Ronnie Sr. was a hit, Ronnie Sr. would be dead. He would have been shot.
He would have been killed at his dealership.
In the car as he was
leaving. He would have been stuffed in a fucking trunk.
Yeah.
Because if the bodies are left there, they're meant for a message, and they're not going to be in a house.
Yes, and also, again, the mafia, I think in the movie Goodfellas says, when they come to kill you, it's not a lot of shouting and gunfights. They come to you as a friend. Ronnie would have been taken. Ronnie Sr. would have been taken out to dinner, and as they're walking to the car, done.
Given his status as a sole survivor and potential witness, Butch was taken to the Suffolk County Police Department for questioning. Officers initially treated him with care, providing food and water, while subtly, that's spelled wrong, probing for more information. That's subtly. It's not subtly.
Subtly?
Right? Am I wrong?
I don't know.
Pretty sure that's not subtly. But maybe it is. Butch's demeanor shifted through the night. At times, he appeared deeply shaken, but moments later, he would speak calmly and even joke with officers. Detectives pressed Butch for details about Fellini and the supposed mob threats. When he asked how the hitmen entered the house without waking anyone, Butch faltered, offering vague explanations. Plus, how would he know? He wasn't there.
I never understood how he knew this guy. He must have. I mean, they must have had some
mob connections. Honestly, I think his dad had mob connections.
Yeah.
We won't ever know.
Yeah.
But I think his dad had mob connections.
I mean, well, again, his father's uncle was a mafia member, so yeah.
And plus, you gotta remember, like, even if the dad stayed out of it, out of the mob stuff, the stories are still told.
Oh, yeah.
Especially the old Italian families like that. That they're so close knit, especially with other Italian families, those stories get handed down and down and down. So that man was known.
So, sure.
So officers also questioned why no neighbors reported gunshots. Butch suggested the killers might have used silencers, a claim disproven by forensic evidence showing that the rifle lacked a suppressor, which you can tell based off of the rifling on the bullet. So a suppressor has no rifling on the inside. Mm-hmm. And for those that don't know, rifling is a spiral pattern on the inside of the barrel that allows the bullet to spin. Well, when you get to a suppressor, there's no rifling in there, so the bullet just goes straight through. And that helps quiet the muzzle.
That's why we don't use muskets anymore, because those are all smooth barrel.
Correct. So, and that rifle, I know for a fact, because I own one like it, does not fit a suppressor. Yeah. suppressor, guess what? We'll not suppress that thing. That thing is too loud. My gun's bigger. My gun's a lot bigger. But it is loud as fuck. As detectives cross-referenced Butch's statements with evidence from the crime scene, they noted discrepancies. For instance, Butch claimed he was at work during the murders, but his co-worker stated that he had left early that day and behaved strangely. Investigators confronted Butch with the implausibility of his story, pointing out the lack of forced entry and the absence of Fellini in the area. Forensic evidence showed no signs of sedatives in the victim's systems, contradicting Butch's claims that the family might have been drugged. During questioning, Butch accidentally referred to the details of the crime scene that had not been made to the public. This revelation raised red flags, as only someone involved in the murders could know such specifics. Now, devil's advocate on this part. He saw the crime scene first. So even if he didn't commit the murders, and we don't know what he saw, what he said, we don't know. But he did see the crime scene first. So it could be argued that that's how he knew this, because he went in there, saw that his parents were dead, and then came out and got help. So, devil's advocate, he could have said that, but obviously we know that he committed the murders.
I don't believe they've ever given a transcript of the interview.
No, I would love it. After hours of intense questioning, Butch's composure broke and he confessed. It all started so fast. Once I started, I just couldn't stop. He admitted to shooting his parents first, followed by his siblings, detailing the sequence of the murders. When asked why he killed his entire family, Butch claimed he was driven by anger and frustration, describing his father as abusive and his family as better off dead.
And you hear a lot of this in family annihilation people who commit these crimes. They always end up with that, they're better off dead.
Doing it for them.
Yeah.
The murder weapon was identified as a .35 caliber Marlin rifle, which Butch had owned for some time. Ballistic tests confirms that the bullets recovered from the victims matched the rifle, solidifying Butch's guilt. And then just for reference, in case nobody has seen it, but you can see how similar it is to mine. Mine just has a scope on it.
Yeah.
Because mine's longer range. Beautiful rifle. Marlin makes some of the best guns. So each victim was face down with no signs of struggle, of resistance. This detail baffled investigators, as the sound of gunfire from the rifle would have been loud enough to wake the other family members. One theory suggests that Butch might have used coercion or surprise to position the victims before killing them. I don't believe so. I think he just moved so fucking quick. He knew what he was doing. He knows the layout of the house. So he knows mom and dad are going to wake up if they hear gunshots. So go to them first. Because his bedroom, from all I understand, is his bedroom's on the second floor.
All the kids were.
Yes and no.
I think all the kids are upstairs.
Yeah, I think his was also in the... I think he had a... Like, they had, like, something in the basement. Because that comes into play later.
But here's the thing. If his bedroom's upstairs, why did he go downstairs first and then go back up? Because the parents are the ones that are going to wake up first, especially his dad. So he goes down there, takes the two of them out. Then immediately goes up, big sister, the next one that could take him out. Then younger and younger and younger. And then goes back through, drags their bodies, positions all of them, tries to make it look like a mob hit. That's why I think he positioned them after. Wasn't any kind of sexual thing. It was trying to make it look like a mob hit. He got no gratification out of this.
I think he just... Well,
he was done. He was over.
I think I'll say what I'm going to say until the end. But yeah.
The medical examiner determined that the murders occurred around 3 a.m. The precise timing aligned with Butch's statement, though it also raised questions about how he was able to execute the killings so efficiently without alerting the neighbors. The quiet suburb of Amityville was rocked by the news of the murders. Residents who had long considered the DeFeos a nice, normal family struggled to reconcile this image with the grisly reality. The high-profile nature of the case, combined with Butch's changing narratives, drew significant media attention. Headlines speculated about possible mob ties, mental illness, and even supernatural forces, laying the groundwork for the later legend of the Amityville Horror.
Yeah!
Butcher's confession revealed deep-seated anger and resentment toward his father, whom he described as tyrannical and abusive. Psychologists later speculated that years of physical and emotional abuse had created a psychological break, fueling Butch's capacity for violence. Butch admitted to using heroin and LSD regularly, both of which may have impaired his judgment and heightened his aggression.
No.
The trial of Ronald Butch DeFeo Jr. Don't call me Butch. Began on October 14th, 1975, less than a year after the shocking murders of his family. The proceedings would become a battleground between two opposing narratives. The defense's claim of insanity, which painted Butch as a deeply disturbed individual incapable of controlling his actions, and the prosecution's insistence on his full responsibility for the calculated and deliberate murders. The trial, filled with dramatic revelations and conflicting testimony, not only captivated the nation, but also left lingering questions about the nature of justice, mental illness, and accountability. The trial took place in Riverhead, Long Island, with the local community still reeling from the gruesome murders. Public interest was intense, fueled by media coverage that alternated between sensationalism and serious analysis of the case. Many locals were divided in their opinions of Butch. Some saw him as a victim of a deeply dysfunctional family, while others believed he was a cold-blooded killer. The courtroom was packed with spectators and journalists, all eager to witness the unfolding of one of the most infamous cases in American criminal history at the time. The trial's blend of forensic evidence, psychological arguments, and shocking testimony made it a riveting spectacle. And this was like the first of its time. This much forensic evidence and all this psychological stuff, especially on a kid like this. And I will say right now, we know the defense is trying to do mental illness and all that. I've seen what a mentally ill person does when they kill somebody. This is not it. This was cold. This was calculating. Mental illness, especially towards his father, he would have done much worse than what he did. This was cold-blooded killing. That's it. The prosecution, led by Gerard Sullivan, argued that Butch's actions were premeditated and methodical, driven by resentment and greed. They sought to portray him as a manipulative and self-serving individual who is fully aware of the consequences of his actions. The defense, led by attorney William Weber, presented Butch as a man in the throes of severe mental illness. They aimed to prove that he was not responsible for his actions due to his inability to distinguish right from wrong at the time of the murders. Which I think is a crock of shit. I hate defense attorneys. Cannot stand them. Especially when they defend somebody that's guilty. The prosecution highlighted Butch's actions in the hours following the murders, including his calm demeanor, attempts to establish an alibi, and efforts to mislead the police by suggesting a mob hit. Sullivan emphasized that Butch's decision to dispose of evidence, such as the rifle and bloody clothes, indicated clear forethought and an awareness of guilt. Prosecution argued that Butch was motivated by financial gain, particularly his desire to collect his parents' life insurance policies. Witnesses testified that Butch had expressed frustration about his financial dependence on his father and had previously threatened to kill him.
It sucks, man. Dad won't give me any money for drugs.
Yeah.
Basically what it was.
And here's the thing. If we're talking about mental illness, nobody that's mentally ill would have... Maybe you lied to the police, but would not have established an alibi this entire time, waited 15 hours to confess. If you're mentally unstable and you know you're mentally unstable, you confess.
It was longer than 15 hours. It was 15 and a half hours-ish from the time of the murders to when he reported the murders.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You said until he confessed. He confessed days later.
No, I meant until everything happened. So that's not somebody that's mentally unstable. That, and I'm not saying he wasn't. He's a druggie.
There's a difference between being he's crazy or he's crazy. I'm making the little circle motions around my thing.
He's a fucking tweaker. So
he's a junkie. He's got a junk. This is a junkie's mentality.
Forensic experts detailed the systematic manner in which the murders were carried out. Each victim was shot in bed, face down, with no signs of struggle, suggesting that Butch had acted with cold precision rather than in a fit of rage or delusion. Toxicology reports on Butch at the time of his arrest showed no significant traces of drugs or alcohol in his system, countering the argument that he was intoxicated or impaired during the murders. The insanity plea. Butch claimed that he had been hearing voices urging him to kill his family, describing them as demonic commands that became impossible to resist. Weber presented this as evidence of paranoid schizophrenia, arguing that Butch was delusional and unable to comprehend the reality of his actions. The defense emphasized the abusive and volatile environment in the DeFeo household, particularly the toxic relationship between Butch and his father. Testimony from friends and neighbors supported the narrative of a controlling and violent patriarch who created a pressure cooker of resentment and instability. Dr. Daniel Schwartz, who is a psychiatrist, testified that Butch suffered from paranoid schizophrenia and had experienced a psychotic break at the time of the murders. He argued that Butch's mental illness rendered him incapable of distinguishing right from wrong, fulfilling the criteria for insanity defense. The prosecution psychiatric expert, Dr. Harold Zolon, refuted Schwartz's claims, asserting that while Butch displayed antisocial personality traits and had a history of substance abuse, he was fully aware of his actions and their consequences. Butch's testimony was marked by dramatic mood swings, ranging from defiance to apparent remorse. At times, he seemed eager to shock the court with graphic descriptions of the murders, while at other moments, he claimed to have no memory of his actions. He recounted hearing voices in the days leading up to the murders, claiming they were unbearable on the night of November 12, 1974. Under cross-examination, Butch's inconsistencies became apparent. He frequently contradicted himself, offering different accounts of the events surrounding the murders. At one point, he implied that his sister Dawn had been involved, an allegation unsupported by forensic evidence. Oh, yeah, my little sister helps me kill my family, and then I killed her. She had no reason to. I mean, she did, but... Witnesses described the DeFeo household as troubled, with frequent arguments and physical confrontations between Butch and his father. These accounts painted a picture of a young man pushed to the brink by years of abuse and neglect. Officers who interacted with Butch on the night of the murders testified about his calm demeanor and his initial attempts to mislead them. Their observations reinforced the prosecution's argument that Butch was calculating and aware of his actions. The trial attracted significant media attention, with journalists scrutinizing every development. Public opinion was divided, with some viewing Butch as a victim of his circumstances and others as a manipulative killer. During one session, Butch claimed to hear voices in the courtroom shouting, "Can't you hear them? They're telling me what to do." This outburst briefly disrupted proceedings, with the defense arguing it demonstrated his mental instability. Well, the prosecution dismissed it as an act.
It was 100% an act.
Of course it was.
Kind of very convenient that they...
happened in a courtroom full of people.
Yeah.
The heated exchanges between the defense and prosecution became a focal point, with both sides presenting compelling arguments about Butch's mental state and culpability.
I will say this, though. It is... So... Ronnie DeFeo Jr. was in his 20s when this happened. 23. That is a fairly typical time when a lot of mental illnesses like schizophrenia start to manifest themselves. Not always, but it is about, I believe that is about an average age. It is not uncommon for people when they start hearing it to self-medicate with alcohol and drugs to quiet it down. But if anything, the drugs obviously are bad, but if anything, the drugs should have probably suppressed the voices in his head. These seem to have amplified them. Because he finally, I'm pretty sure he was probably high as guy would get.
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure he was on LSD, too.
He said, yeah, LSD and heroin, so.
He wasn't. That stays in your system for a while. They drug tested him when they arrested him, and there was nothing in his system.
Hmm.
There's no alcohol, no drugs. That stuff, there's traces in your system for, like, I believe it's 72 hours.
Oh, okay.
There was nothing in his system.
So he was stone cold sober when
yes,
he did it.
Yes, that's why I said it's there's nothing mental. This he meant to do this.
Oh yeah.
He can't say, "Oh, I was high." No, they drug tested him when they took him in. They did a test, they did a blood test. No alcohol, no drugs whatsoever. He was stone cold sober.
Hmm.
And after 15 hours, that would still be in your system. I mean, everybody knows just from getting drug tested how long weed stays in your system. So
weeks.
Meth and all of that, it stays in there a while. On November 21st, 1975, the jury deliberated for less than 7 hours. That is quick in a murder trial. Most of the time it takes days. Before finding Butch guilty on 6 counts of second-degree murder. The verdict reflected the jury's rejection of the insanity defense as they believed Butch was fully aware of his actions and their consequences. So, like I said, I've been on jury trials, most of them last days, especially when it comes to murder.
Oh, because they want to take the time.
Yeah, and there's a lot of deliberation. You'll get people that are torn and stuff like that, especially in a case like this. I don't think it was unanimous. If I remember right, it was not unanimous.
Can't remember.
Now, the argument I will say is they gave him second-degree murder. I don't agree with that.
Mm.
I think it should have been first. Do we remember the difference between first and second?
First, they have to prove that it was a deliberate or premeditated, where it's very hard to describe. It's hard when there's, like, little to no evidence of if it was premeditated, which it was most definitely premeditated.
So, first-degree murder is intentional and premeditated, where second is intentional and reckless. I don't agree with them giving him second-degree, but no matter what it is, they both still hold life sentences.
Yeah. I think they were just being safe.
Yeah.
Because I think the fact that there was abuse and it was pretty brutal, I'm sure the prosecution didn't want the jury being like, being too sympathetic to him. I think they just went for the safe option. Second degree murder, like you said, still gives them, especially 6 counts, that still gets you a life sentence.
Judge Thomas Stark sentenced Butch to 6 consecutive terms of 25 years to life, ensuring that he would never leave prison. In his remarks, Stark described the murders as the most heinous crimes ever committed in Suffolk County. In the years following his conviction, Butch filed multiple appeals, each time claiming new versions of events, including allegations that Dawn was complicit in the murders. None of his appeals were successful, and his shifting narratives only further cemented his reputation as an unreliable narrator. The trial highlighted the challenges of using an insanity defense, particularly in high-profile cases, where public sentiment and media coverage can influence perceptions of guilt. The DeFeo trial, coupled with the subsequent haunting claims by the Lutz family, became cultural phenomenon, inspiring books, movies, and debates about the nature of evil and accountability. And the Lutz family we'll get into
next episode.
In the next episode. So let's go over the lingering mysteries.
And there are some legitimate lingering mysteries here.
and we'll discuss each one. So even after Ronald Butch DeFeo Jr., his conviction and sentencing for the murders of his parents and siblings, the case left a trail of unanswered questions and unresolved mysteries. How could such a calculated and brutal crime occur without anyone waking or hearing the shots? Was Butch truly alone in the house that night? And what role did the alleged supernatural elements later immortalized by the Lutz family's claims play in perpetuating the legend of the Amityville Horror? These lingering mysteries and speculations have continued to fascinate and confound investigators, researchers, and the public. The first mystery is the position of the bodies. All six of them were lying face down in their beds, their hands above their heads, in what appeared to be a peaceful sleeping position. There were no signs of defensive wounds, struggles, or efforts to escape. How could Butch have killed each family member without waking the others? The .35 caliber Marlin rifle Butch used is loud, with no evidence of a silencer. Despite this, neighbors reported hearing nothing unusual apart from a family dog barking intermittently that night. Early theories suggested that Butch may have drugged his family before killing them. However, toxicology reports showed no sedatives or drugs in the victim's systems. Investigators pieced together a likely sequence of the murders, beginning with Ronald Sr. and Louise on the first floor, followed by the children upstairs. It remains unclear why none of the victims woke up during the gunfire, which would have been deafening within the confines of the house. Again, some theorize that Butch may have coerced his family to lie face down before executing them, though no evidence directly supports this claim.
Well, one of his sisters was shot in the face, but found face down.
Correct.
It's odd, because...
I do believe... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
It's odd that nobody woke up. Well, besides the mother. That's it.
Yeah.
That's all they claimed to wake up was the mother... after he shot the father.
I think it's obvious. You're right. It's obviously clear that we know the parents went first. I think the kids they woke up, but I don't think they got out of the beds. Because again, the parents would know. They grew up in Brooklyn. They would know what a gunshot is. So, and obviously they were the main focus of his anger. And so he, no matter what, he would have killed them first. It makes why would he kill his little baby brother or anything first? I mean, the children just seem like, well, they're better off without being here. So he goes in, dad, boom, mom, boom, boom, dad. Okay, yeah, everyone's awake, but again, they're like, what's that? We know when we hear something loud and popping, we know to just run out and get in. Seek cover because we've been trained to know what a gunfire is, but do a bunch of kids know that? They don't know that. Not really. They're not cops. They're not soldiers. So he goes up, he opens the door, and maybe Dawn looks and is like, what's going on? Boom. He goes to the next room, and then he just proceeds down. I don't think anyone ever got out of their beds. Not really. They may have been awake. They probably, unfortunately, probably the last thing they saw alive was their brother shooting them, but I don't think these kids ever got out of bed because they didn't know what the hell was going on. Or at least by the time they realized it was too late.
And they just bit the bullet.
That's fucked up.
That is really fucked up, dude.
Fucked up. I'll make fun of Ron Sr. all day long. He's a piece of shit who beat the shit out of his family, but not the kids.
Yeah, the kids no.
It's fine. So, was Butch acting alone? Over the years, Butch provided multiple versions of events, including claims that his sister Dawn and two unidentified friends were involved in the murders. In one version, Butch alleged that Dawn had killed their siblings after a heated argument with them, and he killed Dawn in a rage. Butch later recanted the story, adding to the confusion surrounding his claims. While traces of unburned gunpowder were found on Dawn's nightgown, experts testified that this is likely due to the proximity to the rifle, not because she fired it. No evidence was found to suggest that anyone other than Butch handled the murder weapon. Butch's claims that he had friends with him that night remains unverified. Investigators could not identify or locate these supposed accomplices, leading many to believe that they were fabricated to shift blame. Skeptics argue that Butch's ever-changing accounts are a calculated effort to sow doubt and potentially reduce his culpability.
The theory is interesting because the theory I heard it came from either a retired Suffolk County detective or it was a private investigator. But the idea was that Butch and Dawn entered into a murder-suicide pact. Butch killed the parents, Dawn killed the siblings, and Butch was supposed to kill Dawn, and then he was supposed to kill himself, but he chickened out at the end.
That's one theory. But there's no evidence proving that. Exactly. Because they were all shot with the same weapon.
Exactly. Unless somehow by a miracle he got the exact same rifle and then decided to dispose of one rifle, not the other one.
It wouldn't matter. Even the exact same rifle is going to have different rifling patterns.
Exactly.
And these are all the same rifling.
So, the lack of noise. Despite the rifle's loud reports, none of the nearby neighbors reported hearing gunfire. Only the DeFeo family dog's barking was noted during the night of the murders. Quiet suburban street combined with the absence of other reported disturbances made this anomaly particularly perplexing. Some suggest that the house's structure and insulation may have muffled the sounds of gunfire. However, this theory has not been substantiated. Reports indicate it was a windy night, which could have carried the sound away from the neighboring homes.
Maybe they just weren't paying attention.
It was at 3 a.m.
Yeah, everyone's sleeping.
So they hear gunshots.
I mean, this is 1970s, so it could have been a car backfiring.
They think that it's...
I mean, how many times have we slept through pretty nasty storms that were like thunder and lightning?
I take melatonin to knock myself out during storms.
I've slept through, even without drugs, like sleeping aids.
I sleep through it without meth.
It's entirely possible. Everyone just slept through. I didn't hear anything. Yeah, no shit. You were asleep and dead to the world. And even if you were, you would have to be awake. And again, if you're not hearing it, you watching TV or something else, you're probably just not going to hear it. And again, this is a suburban neighborhood and they are there, but this isn't like New Jersey, where everybody is like really close together. There was some space in between those homes.
So what was his motive? The prosecution argued that Butch was motivated by greed, aiming to collect his parents' life insurance policies. Evidence showed Butch's frustration with his financial dependence on his father and his recent staged robbery attempt at the family dealership. The defense highlighted the abusive dynamics within the DeFeo household, particularly between Butch and his father, as a catalyst for his actions. Psychiatrists noted Butch's deep-seated resentment toward his father, combined with years of substance abuse and mental instability. Some believe that Butch's motives were a combination of all these factors, exacerbated by drug use and untreated mental illness. Others argue that the murders were a calculated act of revenge against a family Butch felt had failed him.
So with the life insurance policy, if I remember correctly from the research I've done, it was he tried to cash in on the life insurance policy within like a couple days of the murders. A couple days to a week. It was a very quick turnaround that he tried to collect the life insurance policy.
It takes a while to get you an official death certificate, and that only occurs when the coroner is satisfied that they've investigated how the cause of death and everything, and they didn't just give the money to the guy who killed them.
Yeah.
So, and he was pretty much a suspect almost from the beginning, so pretty much.
Well, not like at the beginning, he was more of a person of interest just because he's the only surviving family member.
Yeah.
But then when his lies started to unfold, that's when he became a suspect.
Yeah, so he wasn't getting that death certificate anytime soon.
No.
We'll skip number 5 because that is stuff that we'll talk about in part 2.
Yeah. Yes.
So the psychological state. Butch's defense psychiatrist diagnosed him with paranoid schizophrenia, citing his claims of hearing voices as evidence. The prosecution's expert countered this diagnosis, labeling Butch as antisocial, with full awareness of his actions. Some psychologists believe Butch may have suffered from an undiagnosed condition, including borderline personality disorder, BPD, or intermittent explosive disorder, IED, which could explain his erratic behavior. Others argue that his drug use and history of manipulation point to a deeply flawed but mentally competent individual.
Yeah, he was troubled from the drug use and the abuse, but I mean, no, he wasn't crazy.
No. We'll skip number 7 too, because that's kind of
has
to do with paranormal. Decades after the murders, the DeFeo case continues to inspire debate, books, movies, and documentaries. Questions of motive, method, and possible supernatural involvement remain central to its lasting allure. The Amityville murders have become a unique blend of verified criminal acts and speculative folklore, blurring the lines between reality and fiction. The crime reveals the destructive potential of unresolved family dysfunction, untreated mental health issues, and unchecked anger. This tragedy continues to captivate and horrify, standing as a cautionary tale of how outward appearances can mask internal chaos. Now, 1 year later, the Lutz family moves into the house, claiming it is haunted by malevolent spirits. Their story becomes the foundation of the Amityville horror legend. Was their experience a genuine haunting or an elaborate hoax born of greed and imagination? Find out in the next episode.
And just to add on, Ronald DeFeo Jr. has passed away on March 12th, 2021, at 69 years old and at the Albany Medical Center in Albany, New York.
69. He got fucked.
And if I believe he never spoke really of
appeals.
Yeah, and even those actually stopped after a while.
Well, you only get so many.
True.
But. Yeah, so we want to thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening. Please remember to turn in your glasses, push in your seat, and as always, tip the bard. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Clink.